you got
problems that you ought to be concerned with.
Moolah!
You don't know how you're supposed to earn it, or what to do with it, or how to keep it. You're a freak with a dark, shameful secret.
But you're not the only one. Hit your hidden financial fears with a blast of sun. Now your healing has begun. It's Bad with Money with Gabby Dunn.
Hello, I'm Gabby Dunn, and this is Bad with Money. We're back. Can you believe it? Sometimes I can't. Today's episode is really getting into the coronavirus of it all. We're going to talk about buying safety. Folks who made a good amount of money or worked in a generally lucrative field before the pandemic are probably reaping some nice benefits of the job right now. Maybe that's working from home or not having to work at all. And they're definitely mitigating exposure to the virus by ordering groceries or other necessities to be delivered. For the people who get to do all of that, or even some of that, it means they probably worked a job a lot of people could appreciate. But since the pandemic, how we're looking at work and the value we assign to jobs has changed. Before, we largely valued jobs based on how well they paid. I don't know, that's logical. Look how valuable it is to have money to buy yourself the ability to isolate yourself right now. So getting paid a lot pre-pandemic helps you during pandemic. But I came across this really interesting article in The Atlantic about how we're beginning to redefine the value of working class jobs. Since the pandemic began, essential workers are the ones who are making sure we still have groceries, the ones delivering people the things they need. They're essential, but they're unable to afford to be safe. So now it's like there's this class war between the well-off and the working class, which is long overdue. Why can only wealthy people afford to be safe? Especially if their jobs aren't the ones that society turns out really needs to keep going. So in this episode, we're going to get into it. We got in touch with the reporter at The Atlantic that wrote that article. Her name is Olga Hazan, and I really wanted to talk to her about what's going on. Like the protesters from conservatives who want the economy to reopen, even if it means putting lives in danger, most notably the working class, to the sticky question of how should we be thinking about the fact that people making minimum wage are being asked to risk their lives so that other people can stay safe. I've had a lot of this on my mind for a long time now. I'm kind of obsessed with it, so let's talk about it. All right, we're going to give her a call. So can you tell our listeners who you are and what you do?
Yeah, I am a reporter with The Atlantic. I'm a staff writer at The Atlantic, and I cover health and science.
Wow. So you're on the tip right now.
Yes, I'm very busy.
So you wrote an article called How Coronavirus Could Create a New Working Class, which was incredible, an incredible read. Can you sum up what you meant by that?
Yeah, so I really wanted to look into the fact that so many of the people who are most vulnerable to infection risk right now are people who are in relatively low-wage jobs that didn't necessarily ask to be in that position. So they're, you know, people who work in grocery stores, or people like pet groomers, or people who work in warehouses, who kind of just wanted a job, make, you know, $15 or so an hour or less, and don't get health insurance. And here they are, they're like within arm's reach of hundreds of people every day, and they're being exposed to coronavirus when all, you know, everyone else is safe and working from home. So I kind of wanted to look at like the fallout of that and what the consequences of that might be, both politically and for the workers themselves.
Yeah, the opening of the article is really visual and striking. It says, I like this part. I'm going to read your own article back to you a little bit as a fan. So it said, the poor got socially close so that the rich could socially distance. And that's kind of a thing that I've been trying to wrap my brain around this entire time as someone who does a podcast about money. Like, the poor sacrifice so the wealthy can live. And that's kind of like, you talk about a thing that has gone on in history like over and over and over again when it comes to plagues. Can you speak a little bit about the cholera story from Germany?
Yeah, totally. So this was a really interesting parallel that I found. Obviously, like there's been a lot of plagues in history, and but I wanted to focus on this one in Hamburg, Germany, that happened in 1892, and it was a cholera epidemic. So Hamburg, it just has this a lot of kind of different parallels to the U.S. in the way that it was thinking about workers and the economy. Hamburg was controlled by these wealthy businessmen, and they really didn't think that public health was an important investment. So they didn't have like a water filtration system in place. The housing in the city was kind of bad. And so all these workers were really exposed to the cholera. And so you had this this horrible epidemic. Within just 6 weeks, 10,000 people died of cholera because there were kind of no public health protections in place. And it was almost like kind of interesting because the merchants in Hamburg actually downplayed the cholera epidemic at first, and they kind of resisted imposing a quarantine on the city. Because they thought it would be bad for economic growth.
Shocking. It's almost like we've never learned our lesson once in the history of time and space.
Right. I guess we don't really learn about this Hamburg cholera because it's like it's exactly what happened.
Yeah. Nobody likes to learn history. Everyone's just like, oh, you know, I'm sure. Well, just kind of what your article is about. But like, yeah, I'm sure everything will be fine.
Right. And so, but like what I thought was like really awful about this is that, you know, obviously like the wealthy people in this city could afford to have other people boil their water and like clean their bathrooms and stuff. But the people who were actually like living by the docks and like drinking the dirty water that had cholera in it were the ones who died.
Right. Of course. And so, okay. So self-isolation is a luxury economy. And I'm sure people are slowly waking up to and realizing what that means. But can you talk about what luxury economy means?
Yeah. So this was just a researcher that I talked to who writes about like the white working class. And it basically just means that in order to like, quote, work from home, like you have to be basically rich. Like you have to have the kind of job where you're like writing tweets or you know, basically like sending press releases or doing whatever else that you don't have to be somewhere physically for. Like if you're an Amazon warehouse employee, you can't work from home.
Right.
Or if you work at Walmart, you can't work from home. So it's just talking about this gap between the people who work from home and people who have to come in.
Yeah. I mean, so it's really become this strange thing about like who is an essential worker. And that has come up a bunch. Like who is essential? Who, you know, who has become an essential worker? Can you talk a little bit about like how that's changed?
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, I feel like especially at the beginning of the outbreak, there was just like a lack of recognition of the fact that essentially like Walmart and Target and like Trader Joe's employees were going to become essential, right?
Yep.
Like the people who provide your groceries and who take Cheerios off the truck and put them on the shelves are essentially like essential employees. But you know, for the longest time, they didn't have masks. Their companies, when they did implement like paid sick leave, they would tell them like, oh, well, you have to have a positive COVID test in order for us to give you any days off.
Good luck.
And they were like, well, I can't get one because they're impossible to get. You know, they would quarantine themselves because they didn't want to miss out on their paycheck. Like it was just like this big mess because these jobs have always been considered like low skill or like low like status in our society. And they've never had the kind of benefits that you would expect to see at a job that is essential. Which is like the kind of benefits we have. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, I think people's mindsets shifted to what is essential and what isn't. I was looking at the protesters for Operation Gridlock and the people that have been protesting to reopen the economy. And a picture that stuck out to me was a white woman, shock of all shocks, holding a sign that said, I want a haircut. And I was like, you know, what's interesting is like she wants this haircut because she is presumably of a certain economic status. But like, what about the haircutter, the barber, the hairdresser? Like that person is probably working for like tips, or at least a lot of mine are freelancers and they buy out the little chairs in the salons. Like it's this like disconnect of like who is going to expose themselves for you. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah, totally. I think people don't recognize that. And like, I wrote this other story recently about Petco having dog groomers come in and still groom dogs, even though human salons are shut down. And people were like, I mean, look, like a lot of people love dogs, but people like were in on my Facebook page and in my Twitter feed, like, well, like I have trouble cutting my dog's nails. Mm-hmm. And like, I'm like, I understand that, but you realize that you're asking someone to put their life at risk for the sake of like a dog's nails. Yeah. It really has kind of exposed these like, I don't know. There was another article on our site. I won't call them heroes because there was an article on our site about how they hate being called heroes.
Yeah, it's really, it's like heroes are expected to die.
Right. It's like, I actually didn't expect to die when I signed up to work at Trader Joe's.
Right, exactly. Like you're not, reframing them as heroes allows us to feel fine when they die, which is fucked up.
Right, exactly. So I don't know what to call them instead, but it's definitely this group of people who are like, wait a minute, why am I in the line of fire? And I don't know. I guess this article was trying to capture that.
No, absolutely. It was interesting, a part of the article where you talked about how in the past, I think you were like in the 50s, there was a pride to being a blue collar worker. And, you know, I walk up and down my street and there's still construction. There's people still working on these luxury apartments that are down the street from me. They're still being built every day. Not every day. I'm not leaving my house every day, but every time I pass them, I'm like, who's moving in there? We're still on schedule for the construction. These guys are still coming to work and doing that. You know what I mean? But like it's this thing where you mentioned like in the 50s, that kind of stuff was like, I'm the backbone of America. I'm proud. And there was like a pride to being that kind of worker. And then slowly it became like, this is someone who's uneducated. This is some like you could better yourself kind of thing, that now like these people are so valued again. Is that a right thing that could switch back?
Yeah, I mean, so this was like, the article has kind of two perspectives. Like one, everything could just stay the same and get essentially worse. So we could have even more inequality and more like frustration and partisanship. But I mean, there is this chance that like, yeah, I mean, like what you said, I also, you know, there was like a day when I was outside my apartment and everyone had masks on and was avoiding each other by 6 feet, except for the people who were like draining the sewer system or something. And they were all gathered in a circle around the sewage manhole and like without masks on and like fixing our sewage problem or whatever. Right. And like, I was like, well, this is like messed up because, you know, all the people who are, this is their only time outside are protecting themselves. And these guys have probably been working all day without masks on. And it's, you know, I do think that like, recent decades, there's become this sense that Amazon warehouse jobs or, you know, McDonald's jobs or things like that are like these low level jobs. Oh, you better avoid that. You better get an education so you don't quote unquote get stuck there.
Right.
But now it's like when everything, you know, goes to shit, basically, like those are the people who we really rely on. So some researchers think that there might be a return to more of like, you know, the factory man kind of identity of like, I'm a grocery store worker. I am like the most essential person when everything falls apart. Maybe that's wishful thinking, but there is a possibility that it could kind of return to that, that feeling of like pride in your kind of blue collar job.
I worry about that also in a cynical way, because I worry that it's this thing where people, because it's a class thing, people will take pride, in, let's say, being quote unquote heroes and dying for the economy. I was just reading this article. I'm obsessed with this whole idea of like the Republicans are pushing where they're like, well, some people will die to save the economy. And I just like read about that nonstop because it's so wild to me. But you know, it's that thing of like when they say that, who do they mean? And then and then these people are sort of forced to be like, oh yeah, I, you know, like it's like those tweets where they're like, my grandfather died. He was a, you know, grocery store stalker and now he's dead. And everyone's like, your grandfather was a hero. And it's like, I'm uncomfortable like with how this is being framed.
Yeah, totally. I mean, so you're right. And so it's like if we valorize this a little bit too much, is it like seen as like you're a war hero where it's like, get back in there.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Thank you. Let's clap for you from the safety of our luxury condo.
Right. Exactly. So I do think, I mean, there is a risk you know, grocery store workers, I would say, are like pretty essential. But I do think there's a risk for the states that are thinking about opening up their economies too soon, that they'll be like, small businesses, they want to work. And of course, like, these small business, like cashiers and stockers and checkers and things, are not necessarily like, yeah, I'm ready to sacrifice myself for
I know. But then it comes down to social safety nets, where it's like, if we were actually doing that, it wouldn't be, I mean, it's so sad. It's these people protesting because they're like, please, capitalism, take my life. Like, it's like very like, it's, or like, you know, okay, don't take my life, but, you know, take my mom's life. Like, it's this thing where it's like, you're protesting that you're like, I want the freedom to work, but like, it's not actually freedom, because you're like, I need to work. And I feel for those people. I feel for everyone. And like, I feel for like businesses that are falling apart. But it's also like, that you going back to work isn't the answer. The government, like, actually providing social safety nets would have been great.
Right. And I think that's like a really big schism right now in points of view. So I keep returning to, I know this isn't the one I'm on to talk about, but I keep returning to this Petco article, because there was like a really interesting exchange between a Petco dog groomer and the CEO of Petco. They have like an internal messaging system, and she like messaged him, and she was like, hey, I really don't think you're being fair. Like, I'd like to talk about better protections for the dog groomers. And he was like, said something a little bit dismissive, like, I'm missing how I'm not being fair. So many have been laid off, and like, right, you know, be lucky that you still have a job. But like, with the Petco groomers, what I was hearing from these folks that I talked to was like, they actually would prefer to be laid off, like
to get unemployment.
Right. Cause they could then file for unemployment and have a paycheck. Like, the thing I heard over and over again, I've talked to so many workers, like grocery stores, Walmart, places like that. They say like, I want to be home. Like, I want to be home just like you. I want to be safe. I don't want to get sick. Mm-hmm. So it's not like they're not thinking of like, oh, thank goodness, at least I still have a job. Of course it's risky, but like, I will do anything for it. They're thinking, I want the same, you know, like if I got laid off tomorrow, I would file for unemployment. They want that same luxury.
It reminds me of when your flight is getting delayed. And then you're kind of just like, oh, this happened to me in Albany. And I was like, just cancel the flight so we can get the vouchers. Why are you doing this? And it was like, clearly because they didn't want to give us the vouchers. Does that, you know what I mean? And so you're like, you're like, oh my God, if you would just cancel the flight, we could all just take a voucher and go and figure this out. But instead, you keep delaying the flight so that what? So that you don't have to give us the vouchers. And that's like what Petco is doing, basically.
Right. And there's been, I mean, to be clear, like, I've been mentioning Petco the most because that's who I heard from. But like, Petco and PetSmart were in this weird arms race where they both kept their dog groomers on, even as other dog groomers closed down, like the private ones. So it's like, PetSmart closed their dog groomers, and then Petco was like, oh, yay, now we get like a one up on them if we stay open. And then PetSmart opened back up because they didn't want to lose money to Petco.
Oh my God.
Well, so they like, yeah. So it's basically like they're making some money off of this, so they won't close down.
Yeah. And well, and I want to say also, for freelancers, closing stuff down is also like a difficult double-edged sword, because I know for unemployment, it's much harder if you're a freelancer. I've been there.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And I'm not trying to make light of people being unemployed. I just, that's like been the experience of these folks that I've talked to.
No. I think it's like a no win. It's like you're unemployed. Yeah. And I understand wanting to work too. Like, it's just like a total mess that the U.S. did not prepare for or handle correctly at all. Let's pause real quick and take a short break. We'll be right back. And we're back. Can we talk about the people that are buying safety and peace of mind? Because I also read this article. I'm like knee deep in this, or eyeballs deep in this, I guess. Like, I read this article that was like, rich people flying to their safety bunkers in New Zealand. So like, the CEOs of companies and stuff, like flying to their bunkers, and the employees are still working. So like, how is safety and peace of mind being bought right now? Like, who can afford it?
Oh yeah. I mean, and we've been seeing this since like almost the beginning of the outbreak. where, you know, suddenly you had like I forget who was the NBA players getting tested for COVID, and no one else could get tests, and they were like, wait, how are you guys getting tests all of a sudden?
It was like 59 tests for the Utah Jazz.
Right. And people were like, wait, I've been sick for like 3 weeks. There was like this joke going around on Twitter that was like, right now the best way to find out if you have COVID is to sneeze on a wealthy person, because then they'll get they'll get a test. And I think that's just like one of the examples of the frustration that people have been having with like how this crisis has exposed inequality in our society, is that, yeah, like if you're rich, you can get a COVID test, you can afford to go to your private bunker, you can afford, I don't know, I feel like there's all these guides to staying safe from COVID, and they're all like, go to your separate basement apartment and isolate there until you know you're healthy. And it's like people living in like studio apartments or one bedrooms who are like, I don't have that.
Right,
I don't know how I would do that.
Yeah.
So I think that's been where a lot of the frustration is coming from, is like this outbreak has exposed just like how wealthy people are typically able to protect themselves from sickness. And especially now, like that's just happening in a lot more obvious ways and in a lot kind of more blatant ways than before.
Yeah, you talked about how wealthier people generally have fewer underlying health conditions that would exacerbate COVID-19. And, you know, it's interesting. And like, obviously how more people that make more money can work from home. I liked the dissection of the wealthy CEO who has a $3 million bunker who can afford to go there, and the ire directed also at the $50,000 a year blogger, let's say. And can you talk about the ways that those are like getting conflated, or that those, you know, depending on where you put your anger is how things might change?
Yeah. So basically all the experts I talked to predicted that after this, we'll have an increase in populism, or this idea that workers deserve more. But there's like different types of populism out there. So there's sort of the Bernie Sanders style that's more left-leaning. And then there's, you know, Trump is also considered a populist, except he kind of villainizes the like foreigners, or sort of kind of these like
globalists or whatever his boogeymen are of the day. And like outbreaks do have a tendency to make us fear foreigners, to make us fear outsiders.
So if people are like, oh, the like Chinese or the like liberal New Yorkers did this to us, you know, there's a real risk that you could have a doubling down on this kind of Trumpist sentiment of like, we hate outsiders and real America is the only good America. So there is a risk of that. And, you know, it just kind of depends on like how like the narratives are kind of spun out closer to the election, and how people start to perceive, you know, whose fault the pandemic really
was. Yeah, because there's an idea that it could go towards middle class people, or it could go towards like people that are in the middle, because it's easier to fathom those people than it is to fathom like someone like Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk, or, you know, you can't really think, you're like, well, they're a billionaire, so they must have done something right. But the person who has the job one above me, that's someone I can really get mad at.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that actually, yeah, it does, you know, it does happen. Like, so the Washington Post had an interesting profile of this town called Wellsville, Kansas, ironically, mm-hmm. where everyone thought the virus was like this made up hoax. And they thought the media had made it up to like make the president look bad, which I thought was like really funny, because it's like, you know, obviously not, but also that's like targeting the exact wrong thing. Like instead of targeting like the president for not being prepared enough for the pandemic, you're like targeting the media for pointing it out, which like, this is like what you saw in the lead up to Trump's election and is now like happening again.
Normalized
in some cases.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay. So in the article you talk about, I'm going to read part of it. When the dust settles, there's of course a chance that low-income workers might end up just as powerless as they were before. But history offers a precedent for plagues being perversely good for workers. Collective anger at low wages and poor working protections can produce lasting social change, and people tend to be more supportive of government benefits during periods of high unemployment. I feel like I've seen friends who are more centrist all of a sudden being very radicalized by what's going on. I'm worried that the protests and stuff that would be done by leftists are not being done because we actually believe that COVID could kill us, versus like the people that are right wing that are like showing up to the Michigan state house to you know what I mean? Like, what's the right. Is there evidence that people are being radicalized to the left, or is it just it's both, right?
Well, so I will say that the what I've heard or read about the protests on the right, they've been kind of organized or sponsored by some like interest groups.
That's what my partner said. My partner said it's all, my partner was like, it's crisis actors. And I was like, oh, now we believe in crisis actors.
I mean, they're not, I mean, they're whatever, like they, their feelings might be genuine, but that these like, these protests are like, they have messaging and things like that from like groups like Freedom Works, which are all about like free business or whatever. But you know, I think a lot of people are starting to, I think this has really shown us like what the government is for.
Yeah.
Like I've, you know, a lot of people have been like, where are the masks from the like strategic national stockpile? And I feel like this is the first time anyone's become aware that there was a strategic national stockpile or that it should have stuff in it. Mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm. like I feel like, you know, I, for a long time, and I feel like for the majority of the Trump presidency, we were sort of going along with this idea that like, maybe we could just like not have a very strong, like, federal government and it would be fine. And this has kind of shown the flaws in that reasoning.
Well, we're very individualistic. We're like, our thinking is, if I need a mask, I'll just go get one, versus like, well, it turns out you're where? From where, honey?
right. Like, I think this is kind of showing like, and I, you know, with all the restaurants closing and the bars closing and everything, and those people having to draw on you know, the small business loans, mm-hmm. which ended up not working so well. Like, I think it's like this very rapid realization that like, oh God, at the end of the day, like the government is the ultimate safety net and you have to kind of make sure that it's strong, because when everything hits the fan, like that's what you're going to need basically.
Yeah. Except for the doomsday preppers, who I'm very jealous of right now.
I know, right? If only.
I'm very interested too in seeing the ways in which other types of skills are suddenly really valued. Sewing, cooking, mm-hmm. like these very Colonial Williamsburg type, like if you could churn butter right now, like you're the most popular person in your city. Like, it, you know what I mean?
Right.
It's kind of paired everything back to be like, what is actually a skill, or what is actually something that should be paid more, or should have more protections, or should have more benefits, you know?
Yeah, totally. So my apartment building is like a soulless large apartment building where no one talks to each other. But there's like, there's been this very active Facebook group that started up in recent weeks where people are like trading like a carton of milk for mm-hmm. like a cup of sugar and things. And it's like very adorable and colonial and a little bit sad. But like, I do think that this, yeah, I mean, and that's like part of what my article was getting at, is that like, you know, I think for a long time we have like held up the wealthy as like being these amazing people who deserve what they have. And now we're sort of like, wait a minute, you don't actually deserve to be safe from COVID more
yes.
so than me.
So about that, like, how is this conversation about money and who gets to be safe and who's like thriving also about race? I mean, it dovetails with so much stuff, but can you talk about a little bit what you talk about in the article?
Yeah, totally. I mean, so one reason why some experts think that this won't lead to this brilliant renewal of like working class people being treated with dignity is that for the past few decades, and we really saw this in the 2016 election, white working class people have kind of acted in race solidarity with rich white Americans. So rather than like support policies that would help all working class people, white working class people sometimes see themselves as like more white than working class, if that makes sense. Like, they see themselves as like, I should vote with Jeff Bezos because he's just like me, instead of I should vote with like other people who work in my same Amazon warehouse who are, you know, Black and Latinx, because, you know, if we do that, then our conditions might all improve.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing that some of the experts are worried about is that this will happen essentially again in this election, and that you know, because so one of the experts I talked to said white workers with lower levels of education have fled in large numbers to the Republican Party and are increasingly voting based on their ethno-nationalist beliefs, not on class solidarity.
Right.
Which wouldn't like doesn't like really portend like a, you know, liberal kind of victory in 2020.
Yeah. I mean, also it's so much like you could get into like rates of homelessness, which are who are more likely to be exposed to COVID. You can talk about the how the healthcare system ignores or doesn't take seriously the symptoms of, in particular, Black women. And also, I think like the upping of racism, like, you know, poor whites or whites in economically distressed areas attacking Asian people, saying, oh, you're the ones who gave us this disease. Like it's this it's a overwhelming addiction to whiteness as your default setting, which is like, I don't know how many other ways to say that this does not help you at all. And that like,
right.
Jeff Bezos is not your friend, but do you think that there will be, maybe people will wake up and there will be better working conditions? I'm such a pessimist, but I kind of have seen a little bit more radicalization and I've been doing these giveaways on Twitter where people have, friends of mine have been giving me money and I've been giving it out on Twitter, like in small donations, and the sheer amount of people that need help. Like I would hope that that's visible and people could be skewed a certain way and maybe everyone would rise up, question mark.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a really, you know, the short answer is I don't know. I will say, so there's like a couple interesting data points, right? So one study that looked at 15 past major pandemics found that they increased wages for 3 decades afterwards. So you do find that when something like this happens, it does kind of lead to at least a temporary bump for workers that that is good for their wages. Also, I mean, if you just think about it logically, like a lot of companies are giving workers benefits now that they didn't have before, like paid sick leave. It's going to be really hard to take those back once this is all over, because, you know, you're going to remember that you let people stay home when they had coronavirus. Like, are you really going to make people come in when they have the flu? Like,
the worker will remember.
Right. Like people are going to be like, you know, wait, this isn't right. It's like harder to claw things back once you've already given it to people. So that's sort of the one hopeful thing that I have, is that like once someone gets something, it's kind of theirs to keep, because it's just really hard to undo that stuff.
We need to take one last break and then we'll be right back. And we're back. I want to talk about my favorite thing that's happening. Because you wrote in the article, entrenched beliefs about poverty and wealth are already being shaken up. Americans have long revered the wealthy, believing they have earned their place atop the hierarchy. The argument in some quarters has been that people should simply work harder or get more education to escape quote-unquote dead-end jobs like those in warehouses or grocery stores. But today, those jobs are more crucial than middle management and white-collar firms. The thing that I've become obsessed with is how Americans hate celebrities now. Like,
yes.
Okay, so like, I think seeing everyone's homes, like being able to see all these celebrities' houses, because that's where they're posting from now, it has like, there's like no time for it anymore. It's incredible. And can you talk a little bit about like that backlash?
Yeah. So we have had a really curious like obsession with like the Kardashians and whatever else. And like, oh my God, they're so glitzy and fabulous for no reason. But I really think there's been a really strong pushback against that. I even saw something today, like posted about the New York Times had a short article about how to work out at home. And there was like, whatever. It was like, they were straining for ways to like make it seem like you would have enough room in your apartment to do this stuff. And they were like, use your guest room. And someone like circled guest room with like angry, like circles, and like posted on Twitter, like, how dare you like, you know, imply that I have a guest room. And like, I do think that people are like, you know, wait a minute, like I am trapped in a tiny apartment, you know, at best, or I am like trapped going into my grocery store job. And like, how dare you post about your mansion, like,
yes.
Quarantine.
Yes. Like, it's so, like, it happened so fast where we hate celebrities now. Like, it is so funny the way that everyone has turned on celebrity, but also the ways in which certain celebrities have risen to the occasion. Like, Lady Gaga giving money away and things like that. Like, it's really like created this stark cutout of like who has any sort of touch with reality and who doesn't.
Yeah, totally. I think I've also been seeing some stuff about like how it was like someone, it was maybe Bezos or someone else, but they were like, I'm going to donate like whatever amount to help with relief efforts. And it's like, that is such a small, like people were suddenly like, pay your corporate taxes. Like, you know, I think you have this like sudden outburst of like, people wanting these folks to be like good corporate citizens and to like do their part for society instead of just like, you know, donating or showing up on Instagram and saying a soothing like message. You know, I think like there was like a lot of outrage at like Ivanka Trump doing that.
Yeah.
Like, she did like a stay at home like video and people were like, no.
Or well, because you're seeing their houses or like, Mila Kunis and Ashton Kutcher were like, we're going to make a quarantine wine and all the proceeds from the wine are going to go to coronavirus. And then I saw people posting and they were like, who's bottling this wine? Who's in the factory making this wine? You know? And like, I just did not see stuff like that before. There have been so many points where I've been like, why haven't we risen up? Why haven't we taken to the streets? Like, you know, I was living in New York during Occupy, like all these kinds of things. And now I have this like little bit of hope where I'm like, maybe we will. Maybe we'll overthrow everything. Like, could it really happen?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, maybe. I mean, like, so something that I often hear from international people, international observers, I don't know what you call them, but like people elsewhere about the U.S. healthcare system is they're like, wow, it's so bad. How have people not like protested against it yet and like caused it to be different? And I do sometimes wonder if like it's going to take a galvanizing thing like this to be like the thing that just puts the pressure on and you know, suddenly like everyone has health insurance or something. I mean, right now it's only getting worse.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Well, because I would always think that the people that really need the help do not have time to protest. They can't, they don't even have a second to think about why their lives are this way, or they don't even have like, you know, they've got kids, they've got jobs. Like there's no time, they're sick. Like there's no time to think about taking to the streets, or you know, there's no time. I mean, now it's also interesting because a lot of activism has to happen online, so more and more people can get involved, even people who maybe like are homebound and wouldn't be able to actually march in the street or whatever. I don't know. This is the most optimistic I've ever sounded on this show. I'm sure the fans like will notice that. So what can I mean? I guess like, what did you take away from all of your reporting? Like what can the average person listening to this, or what can anyone sort of do?
Yeah, I mean, I would just say, like, very generally, like, two things. One is, like, remember this moment. Like, remember the fact that, like, remember who is in danger right now and, like, how it felt to have all your chickpeas and things delivered to your door by someone who's been out there, like, facing coronavirus all day. Mm-hmm. And, like, carry that spirit forward with you as you go through the rest of your life, even after this dies down.
Yeah.
And you know, and also just like vote, like, you know, like elections matter. And, you know, that it's important to pay attention to these kinds of issues because the people that we vote for, have a big impact on our lives.
And it is hard because they're like, okay, everyone's going to have to vote by mail. Also, we're closing the post office. Like it's very, we keep laughing because it's so horrifying. Like my reaction to like things being awful is to kind of laugh, which friends of mine do not like. But but yeah, I mean, it's like so awful. And I think like the people that are being forced to go into their jobs should they're going to probably remember this forever. I think there'll be long lasting trauma. All these people are suffering, some people way more than others, and there has to be something to come out of it. And if you've done the research that says, you know, for decades afterwards, wages were raised and things were changed the last time there were plagues, like maybe that'll happen here.
Yeah, it's definitely possible. I mean, you know, but a lot still depends on what everyday people do, mm-hmm. and whether everyday people stand up for those people who are in the line of fire right now.
Yes, definitely. I think that was everything, Olga. Thank you so much. The article was fantastic. I'm going to go read the Petco article now. I loved Olga's suggestions of what people can do, which to sum up was, one, remember this moment, because we seem to forget history. And then two, vote, because elections matter. It's really been up to local lawmakers to decide what level of care and forethought is going to go into coronavirus rules and restrictions. I, however, don't know that it will be that simple. I think there's going to have to be some kind of revolution. I don't know how it's going to shake out. I don't have the answers for you, but I'm slightly optimistic. I think it's going to be hard and awful and terrible, and there's going to be a lot of pain. But maybe these things that are being allowed, like paid sick leave, like work from home measures, maybe that will result in a lot of much needed change. I feel like the average listener to Bad With Money isn't the person ordering food to be delivered or ordering groceries to be delivered. It's the person delivering the food. At least from what I've heard from you guys about your lives, I think our listener is the Postmate. And I don't have answers for you. You are going through it, especially because there are no other options. Do we take away your right to work? What if you're the Postmate and this is the only way you're going to be able to get money? And what if the people at Petco, there's half of them that want to stay working because they're just happy to have income still, and the others are scared? There's no right answer. The government should have taken care of all of us, but instead, it feels like we're all having to figure out how to survive this pandemic on our own. And it's getting really divided by class. And guess what? People that want to go back to quote unquote normal, I have bad news for you. America has always been that way. Okay, I know it sounds like the episode is over, but it's not. I still need to say thank you for listening, and thank you for letting me be a part of your quarantine. And I hope that this is helpful or you feel seen or spoken to. Please go a step further to support the show by giving us a great rating and a nice review. I would really appreciate it. Even if you just want to give a 5-star review and then write Gabby is good looking. Also, if you haven't already, make sure you're subscribed on Stitcher or wherever you find your podcasts. The show is produced by Tamika Weatherspoon. Our audio engineer is Brendan Burns, and our audio is mixed by Andy Christens. Our executive producers are Chris Bannon and Josephine Martirana. Original music is composed by Zach Sherwin, Mike Kaplan, and Jack Dolgen, and our theme song is performed by Sam Barbera. Bad With Money is a production of Stitcher. I'm Gabby Dunn, and see you next week.